Great to see you and happy Super Bowl Sunday. If that's something you value, you should value Super Bowl whether you like football or not, because if you don't like football, it's a perfect chance for you to go do anything else and no one will be out there in your way. So it's time to celebrate either way. Well, Friday morning we woke up to what felt like a crisis to me. I got out of bed early in the morning going to take my shower and I felt the floor felt kind of wet. Well, Ann got up a little later, turned on the lights, and there was water pooled in our master bathroom and in our master bedroom on the almost brand new wood floors that we have. So I'm like, I've had a slab leak everywhere I've ever lived. That's probably what it is, but it was just like, with everything else we're dealing with so much on the table, the last thing, you know, but of course it really wasn't a crisis. I have insurance. I called my insurance guy, I called these people that come to dry out your house. I went in the garage and turned off the hot water so it wouldn't do any more damage. We mopped it up kind of. And again, we have insurance. Pastor Jerry, who was an insurance guy for a long time, well, I told him, man, this morning I had to, you know, it was pretty cold in the morning and I had to take a cold shower because our hot water's turned off. And he goes, why are you taking a cold shower? You should have already been checked into the Montage because your insurance company will pay for it. And I'm like, that's an insurance perspective compared to somebody who grew up in Stanton's perspective. But in reality, it'll be fine. I know that, been through it before, you get through it, but it just feels like a crisis. And I think that nowadays, almost everything feels like a crisis. When things don't go our way, there's so much that seems like it's out of our control that people actually turn things into a crisis that aren't really a crisis. A crisis, the word, it's the same root as the word cross. A crisis is a place where you get to a point and now it's critical because a decision needs to be made and how you make that decision determines your future. And in general, when something's critical, it's actually what you do right now is life or death. And life has some of those crises, but we sometimes act like there are a lot more. And most people, if you haven't noticed, don't do well in a crisis. They don't make, you know, decisions well and calmly when it feels like an emergency. But I really value people who do. There are certain people who you want them in a crisis because they are experts at crisis management. And sometimes they aren't people that you would expect, but my mom, for instance, was this way. I mean, she grew up as a little oaky, got married when she was 18 to a guy twice her age, and he has schizophrenia. Life was terrible. He's in and out of mental hospitals, and then he leaves. And she's raising five kids on $75 a week. And yet, she put herself through school. She became an x-ray technician, a radiation therapy technician. She was a first aid instructor. And part of why she could do all of that is if you had an emergency, my mom was falling apart half the time. One time she was in the hospital for a year because she was so suicidal. But boom, if there's an emergency, my mom sprang into action. And I can't even count the number of times as kids, we're driving in the car, there's a big accident. My mom tells the kids to wait in the car and she's over there saving someone's life. Over and over again, she'd come back to the car and act like it was nothing, blood all over. She's like, yeah, they're gonna make it. You know, the ambulance driver said, I saved the guy's life. That was just the way she was. And you look at that, there are certain people who are not so good in a crisis. I remember my son William, when he was younger, they were over at their grandma's house, my mom's house, and William swung a golf club, but the head came off the golf club and the end of the shaft cut Danny's head open. And Danny's bleeding everywhere. Again, I'm thankful that my mom was there. If it had happened while Ann was watching them, it could have been a different outcome. But my mom gets the bleeding under control, gets the two boys in her car and starts driving to the hospital. And the whole way to the hospital, she said, William was going, oh, Danny, you're gonna bleed to death. Oh, it's so bad. I'm so sorry. He goes, when you're going to get to the hospital, they're going to have to put a nail in your head to hold it shut. And, oh, it's going to hurt. Danny, it's going to hurt so bad. William was only 17. No, he's like five. But, you know, that's the way some people react in a crisis. You're just not ready for this. You're not sure how to move forward. One of the best people in a crisis I ever saw was Pastor Chuck, too. He was one of these guys that when it really got serious, he could kind of snap into action. And the legendary story of the time when he took a group of people from Calvary to go to Hawaii, and on the plane, they got a lot of turbulence, and it was bouncing around, and they were wrestling with whether they should return or should they continue to go. And people on the plane were freaking out, even the people from Calvary. And then Chuck just starts singing really in that voice of his, "Heaven is a wonderful place filled with..." And then everybody starts singing it together. And that's who you want to be, the one who brings the calm to the situation. Because no one ever makes better decisions while they're freaking out. Now, as we've come to Acts chapter 27, we see the Apostle Paul in an amazing way, in a horrible crisis, when he is on a ship that's being torn apart, ripped apart, and it's going to sink, and there are 276 people on the boat, and Paul's the one guy on the ship who's a good crisis manager. He handled this situation in a way that you would hope, if you were ever in that situation, that you would handle it. And when we look at how Paul handled this crisis, it gives us some tips on how we might handle the various crises that we find ourselves in life. And to be able to know the difference between a crisis and just an ordinary kind of twist and turn of life itself. But Paul gives us a great picture here. And so if we want to learn about crisis management, Acts 27 is a great place to do it. So you can turn over there if you have a Bible with you. It starts out, Paul and a couple of his friends, Aristarchus and Luke, probably some others, they put him on a ship from Caesarea that was supposed to go along the coast until they could link up with a larger ship so that all these prisoners could be transported onto a big freighter or something and taken to Rome. So they end up going up to Sidon and they land, and you see the relationship Paul already had with the centurion who was in charge. It says in verse 3 that Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him liberty to go to his friends and receive care. So they're there in Sidon, which is present-day Lebanon up north of Syria, and the guy goes, "Oh, you know some people here? Go ahead and visit them. Just be back for the ship." You know. And so then they get on that ship, and they're sailing off, and they head out into the Mediterranean a little bit along. Oh, they found a ship from Egypt, from Alexandria, that they put them on. That ship takes off, and it heads out into the Mediterranean towards Crete. And we see that it landed in a place called Fair Haven, but you couldn't really dock there. They stayed there, but you couldn't stay there very long. So we come to verse 9, and let's look at this. "Now, when much time had been spent there in Fair Haven, and sailing was now dangerous because the fast was already over, Paul advised them." The fast that it's talking about is probably Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Day of Atonement comes by our calendar usually late September, early October. So they had actually a proverb that warned you against sailing after the Day of Atonement, because now you're getting into the sketchy weather. And so Paul advised them in verse 10 and said, "Men, I perceive..." Now, he wasn't saying God has told me. He just said, "You know, I'm thinking from what I know, from my experience," and he had certainly done his share of sailing, "I perceive that this voyage is going to end with disaster and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also our lives." So he's like, "Guys, I'm deeply concerned about taking off from here and heading west in the Mediterranean this late in the year. Nevertheless, the centurion was more persuaded by the helmsman and the owner of the ship than by the things spoken by Paul." It was like, so you're some preacher and a prisoner. These guys are professionals. get out of the way, and we'll do what they think is best. Because the harbor wasn't suitable to winter, and they would have had to go somewhere else anyway. So the majority in verse 12 advised to set sail if by any means they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, opening toward the southwest and northwest, and winter there. So they knew that if they could get around the edge of Crete, they could find a place where they could wait it out. And so it made sense. When the south wind blew softly, at that time there's a nice little breeze blowing, and so they thought they had obtained their desire, putting out to sea, and they sailed close by Crete. So far, so good. But in verse 14, not long after, a tempestuous headwind arose called Euroclydon. We don't really have any references specifically to Euroclydon in extra-biblical literature, but what we do know from reading various accounts in the Mediterranean, there were these certain winds that would come up. Normally when you're sailing, you know which way the wind is going, and you can sail into the wind, no problem. You can sail across the wind, no problem. You can sail with the wind behind you, no problem. But the tricky thing is when you have wind that's more like a hurricane, where it's shifting constantly, and that's what we think this storm was. So when the ship was caught and couldn't head into the wind, we let her drive. They're just like, okay, you're driving ship, and just went with it. Running under the shelter of an island called Clauda, we secured the skiff with difficulty. They finally pulled the little skiff up. And when they had taken it on board, they used cables to undergird the ship. And fearing lest they should run aground on the Syrtis sands, these sandbars that were there, they struck sail and so were driven. This thing with the cables, they call it frapping and sailing, where if your ship, you're concerned about the strength of it, and they have extra cables or ropes, they would hang it over the sides of the ship in front and then pull it back and then tighten it so it would be like an emergency, adjustment to be able to hold the ship in one piece. All of these details, by the way, are fascinating. When you see where they went, where they landed, how all this went down, later on we're going to see that when they sounded, they knew how it was 20 fathoms and then it was 15 fathoms. Makes people believe, all these details makes people think that Luke, who was a researcher and historian, probably got a hold of the ship's log, and that's why he knew all of the information, including how many people are on board and where all of these things happened. So Luke ended up having those records. It's very meticulous. And so they're trying to hold the ship together, but long after, it starts getting worse. Finally, they tighten the ship, and then verse 19, we threw the ship's tackle overboard, all the extra stuff that they hadn't used to hold it together, plus they needed the four anchors that they had, in order to land it, but they started dumping extra weight, lightening the ship. Now, when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest beat on us, all hope that we would be saved was finally given up. Here's a crisis. Luke's talking, and even he said, I figured we were dead. I thought this is over. Everyone, 275 of the 276 people on the boat, thought we're going to die. This is it. There's no way out of this. And so as they're negotiating that, all hope was given away. After long abstinence in verse 21, just hanging in there, and they hadn't eaten, Paul stood up in the midst of them and said, men, you should have listened to me. Thanks. Sometimes that's what a crisis manager does. Like, now do you believe me? And not have sailed from Crete and incurred this disaster and loss. So really what he's doing is establishing himself as the leader. I called this one. And now I urge you to take heart. For there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. I love that. He's like, don't worry, none of you are going to die. We're going to lose the ship, but you're all going to survive. For there stood by me this night, verse 23, an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve. And this angel said, do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar, and indeed, God has granted you all those who sail with you. So he goes, an angel came and told me. it's going to be fine. I'm going to Rome, and you guys, because you're with me, you're going to be fine too. And it's nice to hear somebody with some optimism at a time when everyone else is freaking out. But he says in verse 25, therefore take heart, men, for I believe God that it will be just as it was told me. However, we do need to run aground on a particular island. Now, when the 14th night had come, as we were driven up and down in the Adriatic Sea, about midnight, the sailors sensed that they were getting near land. The jury's still out on Paul's, you know, word from the Lord. They took soundings and checked the depth, and it was 20 fathoms, which would be like 40 yards, 120 feet. A fathom is between, you know, when you stretch your arms out from the tip of one finger to the tip of the other finger, it's about 2 yards. So they said, okay, we're 20 fathoms deep. And, you know, they're thinking, we're getting closer to land. Maybe this guy knows what he's talking about. But they took soundings again, and it was only 15 fathoms. So they're like, we're getting close to land. That could be good or bad, because now we're getting in danger of, if there is a sandbar or something, we could get stuck and can't go any further. Verse 29, then fearing lest we should run aground on the rocks, they dropped 4 anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. They're like, oh, God that talked to Paul, if you're listening, we could use some help here. And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship, when they had let down the skiff into the sea under pretense of putting out anchors from the prow, the sailors were like, we're close enough to land. I think we can make it in the little lifeboat. And so they're pretending like they were putting down the anchor, but really they were putting down the boat, because they're like, we're not going to die with these people. So Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. In other words, it's going to take all of us. Soldiers, you know how to fight. Centurion, you know how to direct soldiers. But none of us are sailors. So if these guys leave, we're probably all dead. And we're really hoping to not be all dead. And so the centurion now listened to him. The soldiers cut away the ropes of the skiff and let it fall off. So the sailors were like, oh, well, I guess we're in it with you. And day was about to dawn. And look at this in verse 33. Paul begged, implored them all to take food, and said, today is the 14th day. You've waited and continued without food, and you've eaten nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take nourishment, for this is for your survival, since not a hair will fall from the head of any of you. And so Paul said, I know this sounds crazy right now, but you guys need to eat, because you're going to need the strength that food will give you. Now, they had plenty of food. It was a ship going from Egypt to Rome full of wheat. So they had plenty of grain on board, probably other food as well. But he's like, come on, man. You guys are going to need every bit of strength that you can get when this all comes down, and when our ship is falling apart, if we're going to get to shore, it's going to be because we're all healthy. And so after he said that in verse 35, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of them all. And when he had broken it, he began to eat. He set the example by eating first. Some people see in this verse a reference to that he served communion, because it talks about Jesus, and we celebrate communion today on the first Sunday of the month. But Jesus took the bread and broke it and gave it to his disciples, and he ate. But that was just what they did when they ate. So it may not be a reference to communion necessarily. But then look at verse 36. They were all encouraged and took food themselves. How could the attitude of one man make everyone else feel encouraged? Well, that's what you want in a crisis. Somebody who has the ability to tell you, look, you're going to need to eat in order to get through this crisis. Maybe you've gone through things in your life that felt like it was life and death, or maybe you lost someone that you love. The last thing you feel like is eating. But one of the first things we tell people who are in crisis is you need to make sure that you eat, because you need that strength. One of the best things you can do as a friend is take somebody to get something to eat, because it gives you, it helps your body to be able to process, and you're going to think much more rationally, and you can move better if you've had something to eat. And so because they hadn't eaten anything, he got them to eat, and they felt encouraged. And in all, we were 275 persons on the ship. So when they had eaten enough, everyone was full, they lightened the ship and threw out the wheat into the sea. They go, this is getting serious now. We're either going to be dead or saved before we need another meal. So let's just dump all this wheat. It's not going to do anyone any good in a sunken ship. And so they did that, and when it was day, they didn't recognize the land, but they saw a bay with a beach under which they planned to run the ship if possible, and they let go the anchors and left them in the sea, loosened the rudder ropes, and they hoisted the mainsail to the wind and made for shore. Again, so much meticulous detail. We don't know of Luke being an expert on sailing, but certainly in the ship's logs, they would keep all of these kind of detailed records, and he was a researcher. But striking a place where two seas met, that is a peninsula with water on either side, they ran the ship aground, and the prow stuck fast and remained immovable, but the stern was being broken up by the violence of the waves. The soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, because they're like, if these guys escape, it's our necks. So soldiers, the Roman soldiers felt pretty competent once they were this close to land, because every Roman soldier was taught how to swim. It was a part of their training. So they thought, we'll escape, but man, if we just kill these prisoners, it'll look like they were lost in the shipwreck, and you know, we'll have our rear ends covered. But so that was their thought. They didn't want any of them swimming away. But the centurion, wanting to save Paul, he's like, no, if you kill the prisoners, you're going to kill Paul. He's the reason we're still alive. So he kept them from their purpose and commanded that those who could swim should jump overboard first and get to land, which would primarily be the Roman soldiers. It wasn't a common thing for people to know how to swim, but Roman soldiers all did. So he goes, instead of killing the prisoners, I got this. You guys, every man for himself, swim for shore. And the rest, some on boards. Again, this is one of the first references to surfing in the Bible. And some on parts of the ship, whatever they could find that would float. And so it was that they all escaped safely to the land. So amazing that in the middle of this crisis, somehow, partly because of the influence of Paul and his faith, everyone, 276 people, survived a catastrophic shipwreck. That was just unheard of. When we look at the story, and I love this story, certainly it's great just as a story, but when I look at it as here's a training, you know, episode. Here's some counsel for us as we face various crises in life. Like, if you want to be a positive force when people are under stress, when people are in danger, when decisions that are made can be life and death, what can we learn from Paul so that we too can be people who react in a certain way that when a crisis comes, we welcome it because we know that there are things that you can do in a crisis that will actually help people survive. So when I went through this chapter this week, I came up with about 12 things and then I'm like, that's too many. So I boiled it down to a few. Here are some basic principles for crisis management that we learned from Paul in Acts chapter 27. First of all, hope and optimism. Courage and confidence is so important. You can never be a leader and be freaking out. You can never be a leader in any positive direction at all if you are, oh no, we're all gonna die. Oh no, we're all in trouble. Oh, we're, you know, that's why our world is so messed up today, is there are so few examples of people who actually have hope. There are people who say they believe in God, but they freak out like God doesn't exist. Like this is all out of whether, oh, the pandemic or politics or economics or or you know, your team didn't make the Super Bowl or whatever, and you're like, ah! Well, that's not what good crisis management looks like. And if you really want to stand out before anything else, if you can keep from freaking out, if you can have a positive spin, now think about it. You know, there's a, you know, that old saying that if you can keep your head when all about you others are losing theirs, then you're a man, my son. And other people have put a twist on that and said, if you can keep your head when all about you others are losing theirs, you probably don't know what's going on. But the question is, I mean, let's say the ship was going down. Would you rather have someone like Paul who makes you believe that there is hope? Or would you rather have somebody who states the obvious, we're in trouble? So it isn't, having hope and confidence is tied to our faith in God, but from a practical standpoint, it doesn't help at all to freak out, to make people more freaked out. You don't make better decisions when you're freaking out. And so the world is hungry, and there won't be a bunch of them. I mean, there are people who think they are in crisis because Facebook blocks some of their posts. It's like, seriously? That's what you think is like, we're, our country is shipwrecked because of this? It's like, get a perspective. Be the one who says, yep, things are looking bad in a lot of different areas, but you know what? I just talked to God, and he seems to think that everything is going to be fine. I tell people this all the time. Talk to God this morning, he doesn't seem worried about what you're worried about. And so having that hope and bringing optimism, it would be worth it even if you're wrong. I'd rather have someone who gives me false hope than somebody who takes any hope that I may have away. Because whatever life I have left, I don't want to live it in a panic. Paul also, and this is intertwined with my first point about hope and optimism, Paul heard from God. He was a man of prayer. He prayed and he sensed what God was showing him, and he wasn't going to apologize for doing that. He talked to a couple hundred pagans and told them, here's what God told me. Here's what he has said. The reason why I am so optimistic and so courageous, it's not within me, it's because of who God is. It's, you know, now the best way to have hope is certainly to live a life of prayer and to have confidence in what God, who he is and what he tells you. By the way, if you lead a life of hope and prayer and belief in God, you will almost always be in a minority. It will never be the case that everyone rallies together on this. There are always going to be people who just want to bail. But if you manage to be a real leader, which, and you've heard me say this plenty of times before if you've listened to me, but one of the most profound things I learned in seminary when one of my professors, old guy, he goes, in the beginning there were two people and they took a vote, and it was unanimous, and they were both wrong, and the majority has been wrong ever since. If you want to have hope, if you want to represent God's perspective, you better be willing to be in a minority. That just comes with the territory. Most people are wrong. It's true in our world today. When we are so divided, if you really want to know the truth, both sides are wrong. You want to pick sides, you're guaranteed to be wrong. If you want to look at a situation and go, I understand what they're all saying, but man, I'm finding God is speaking to me something that puts me in this real sweet spot. That brings courage. That brings calm. And, you know, eventually being right, it'll end up showing you to be right, just like it did for Paul. Another value that I see Paul promoting in this crisis was that he insisted that everyone would stick together. Roman soldiers can't leave. Other people can't be. We all need to stick together. And by the way, we all need to eat. We all need to maintain our strength. Remember when Elijah had gone up to Mount Carmel and challenged the prophets of Baal to a bring fire from heaven duel, and then he won, and it was this great thing, and they killed off all the prophets of Baal. And then Queen Jezebel put a note, put a memo out saying, I'm going to kill Elijah. And so Elijah ran, and an angel came to him, and he goes, you know, take a walk. And he baked him some cakes. Sometimes you just need to have a piece of angel food cake when you're in a crisis, because it helps you to orient and navigate. Sometimes the best thing you can do for someone who is in a personal crisis, and I tell people this all the time, when someone loses a family member that they love or something like that, I just go, make sure that you eat. I know you don't feel like eating. I know you're in a crisis and it doesn't make you go, oh man, I would sure love a burger right now. But friends get their friends to eat. It's the basis for communion, actually. It was the center of their life that we are sharing this meal together. Sometimes the best thing you can do for someone is not to share great wisdom with them, is to take them out for a burger or something. You know, just to, that makes people feel like, oh, I'm getting my bearings. This feels okay. Now, we need everyone on board. When you're in a crisis, if you have someone who draws a line and makes a division, if Paul had been on the ship and he goes, okay, everybody who is with me and accepted Jesus, step over to this side. And it's him and Aristarchus. You know, maybe the centurion would have come with him, Luke would have come with him, but boom, the ship would have gone down. So he says, no, everyone matters. Not just the people that agree with me, we all matter. We will, as Benjamin Franklin said, either we will learn to hang together, or most assuredly we will hang separately. And that is, if in a crisis people become divided, then everyone sinks. Everyone goes down. We cannot afford the kind of division that makes people think we're in a crisis, and so I'm right and you're wrong. This isn't the time. A crisis is not the time to settle your differences. A crisis is a time when you go, we need to stick together. We need everyone to be involved. Everyone matters. All the people on the ship matter. They all do. And so, don't bail out. Don't like flee a sinking ship like a rat. Hang in there, in the situation, and you can be a leader in a crisis. Now, the other thing that I see in this story is they discarded the unnecessary stuff. They were willing to use what they had, like boards from the ship turned out to be good floaties for people who didn't know how to swim to get in. But there were other things like anchors and chains and things like that weren't doing them any good. Ultimately, even the wheat, the cargo, it had to all be thrown overboard so that the ship could get far enough into the sandbar that land would be feasible. And I think a crisis is a great time to get rid of stuff. A crisis is a good time to decide, in this crisis, what do I need and what do I not need? The worst thing to do in a crisis is to be a hoarder, because you will go down with your stuff. In our country, $38 billion is spent every year on storage lockers. That's stuff you don't need. That's stuff that someday on cable, they're going to auction it off and laugh at you for saving that garbage, you know? And yet, oh no, I can't let go of it. Man, a crisis is a great time to decide, what do I really need? What is it that really matters to me? And a person who can share with others what matters is a valuable person. There was an old joke that I still like it, but there was this guy, rich guy, and he's driving his car, let's say a Ferrari, and he crashes off the road, crashes into a tree. The Ferrari gets split in half. It rips his arm off, and his arm is up in a tree, and a guy comes up, and the guy's going, my Ferrari, my Ferrari. The guy goes, your Ferrari, your arm is up in the tree. And he goes, my Rolex, my Rolex. Those are the kinds of values that do not help you in a crisis. That's not what we need. It's not a true story, so I don't feel bad for the guy. And yet, how many of us live our lives in that kind of a way, whereby we don't understand what matters and what doesn't? This is life and death. No one gets out alive. What matters? That should be the question. And someone in a crisis who can help you to see, you know what? You're worried about that stuff? That stuff doesn't even matter. You need to do certain things to survive. Survival is what matters. Later on, you'll be able to handle all of that other stuff. But right now, let's talk about what matters most. And there are many people, I've read stories about people whose house burned down. And they said after first being like glad that they all got out alive, the second thought they have almost universally is, it's such a relief. All my stuff is gone. I don't have to clean my garage. I don't have to go through junk drawers. It's like all gone. And it actually feels liberating. There's so often when God uses a crisis to liberate us from what's holding us back. And if we get to the point where we're like, oh, no. And there are some people who in a crisis just hoard more and more. There are other people who in a crisis just decide, I need to live in a smaller place. I need to live a simpler life. And as somebody who wants to be a crisis manager, somebody who actually helps other people in a crisis, letting them know what matters and what doesn't is huge. And Paul does this here as well. Now, when you think about it, everything that Paul has gone through already, from when he went to Jerusalem and causes a riot in the temple and gets kicked out of the temple, locked up, ends up being arrested, and he shares with Lysias, then he shares with the Sanhedrin the story of his testimony, and then he goes up to Caesarea, and he has this relationship with Felix and Drusilla for 2 years sharing the gospel with them, then sharing the gospel, you know, with Festus, and then ultimately with King Agrippa and Bernice, now with the centurion and with 276 people on a boat, and then we're going to see next week, he gets to share with a few more people when they crashed on the island of Malta. Paul's whole thing was, I want the gospel to be out there. And nothing matters other than that. Everything else pales, including my own safety and my own life, pales in comparison to the amazing message that God loves you, loves all of you. Whether you accept it or not, he still loves you. He sent his son to die for all of you. And all you have to do is say, okay, and he will give you eternal life. That was what drove Paul. And ultimately, whatever crisis we face, the worst thing that could happen in that crisis is not as important as the good news that God loves us, that Jesus died for us, that he conquered death. See, that way, it's not death that's a threat. We look on death like Paul did as like, yeah, I'm kind of torn. On the one hand, it'd be better for me if I died and went to heaven. But on the other hand, there's some stuff I need to do down here. Now, to be excellent in a crisis, it really helps if you're not like, oh, this could be life and death. He was like, doesn't matter. I know I'm going to die, but I'm going to do the most I can with my life. Paul did all of that stuff because he cared about people, because he wanted them to hear the gospel. Even though most of these people, no doubt, rejected the message. I mean, of all the 276 people whose lives were saved because of the way Paul got them to handle this crisis, did most of them become Christians? Probably not. You know, they probably, after all, thought, I've always been kind of lucky. Or, boy, it's a good thing that I thought of myself in that moment. And, you know, but ultimately, for Paul, it's like, it wasn't about that. The gospel is all that mattered. So when we're talking about a crisis, I have to ask you, does the good news of Jesus Christ matter to you? Because in whatever crisis there is, the gospel is what meets us there. Because we define a crisis as, oh, it's critical. I'm in the critical care unit, and The truth is, the fact that Jesus has conquered death means that that's far from being the greatest emergency that you will ever endure. The greatest emergency in your life is whether or not you know that you've come into a relationship with God through Jesus Christ. Does that matter to you? If it does, how often do you look for ways to talk to people just to be able to share that with them? I'm not talking about trying to get them, force them to agree, starting arguments with them, coming up to strangers and bugging them. It's like, who do you find yourself on the ship with in this situation? Or Paul, we'll see next week. Who do you find yourself around the campfire with? So what are you willing to do to show ultimate value, to show what the values of eternity really look like? Because if we become really good crisis managers, but we don't become people who have a message at the end of it, then we help people temporarily. But all these people that didn't die in the shipwreck, they all died eventually. And so Paul's perspective was, I'm going to help you through this crisis because you face a larger crisis about which most of you don't have a clue. And that crisis is what happens to you when sooner or later something goes wrong and you find yourself dying. Are you prepared for that? I hope if you're listening to me and you're here or watching online or whatever, that you've come to the point where you recognize that the gospel is free. All I do is say okay, and he forgives me and gives me a new life. Again, it's who would not agree with that? But if you insist on not going along with the program, you're on your own. Good luck with that. But how many of us understand that enough that we even care if other people hear about it or not? How many people have we invited to come to church, even a simple way of getting someone to hear the gospel? Well, that's a question that we all have to ask ourselves. But, you know, we can, you know, like that song that David Bowie sang, we can be heroes just for one day. It's true. What you do today can either make you a hero or can cause you to miss an opportunity for heroism. And Paul shows us this. We can't all be Pauls, but we can all do everything that he did in this situation in order to be used by God to bring life. And I hope that's something that we will do. We're going to celebrate communion right now. The broken body of Jesus, the shed blood that he had, that he said, never forget this, always remember it. It's what connects us ultimately. And it's a chance for us to remember, boy, whatever else we face in the world today, communion reminds us that sometimes life just hurts. Sometimes it doesn't go a great way for me in the short run. But ultimately, God's love for me and God bringing people to that love, that's way more important to me than just trying to save my own neck. And so communion is where we all celebrate together because every one of us is someone for whom Jesus died. If you're watching online right now, I'd encourage you to just get a little piece of bread and a cup of juice and you can participate with us. We will all, if you didn't receive one of the little cups when you came in, you can raise your hand and there are ushers who will be glad to get you one. But let's pray. Lord, thank you for this amazing story. It's such a great story, but then when we look at what made it great, what made it exciting, thrilling, and ultimately leading to this story that is almost the capstone between this and the next chapter, the story of eternity, of you meeting people in a powerful way. Lord, for those of us who have received you, we gladly receive the bread and the cup today because it reminds us of what you invited us to when you invited us to partake in you, to take our cross and follow you. We want to be united with you so that we can represent you well as we go out from here and approach life. Help us to think of the ultimate crisis manager, you, Jesus, the one who inspired Paul to make the difference that he made. As we receive from you all that you have for us, and Lord, for the people who have never accepted you, I pray that even as they take the bread and the cup, that they will decide right now, today, that they want to be forgiven, that they want their life to start over, that they want to be on the right side of eternity in the long run. So help them to know that when they receive these elements, they're receiving you, as we all are. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.